for a weekend summit amid divisions over key issues on the agenda. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's foreign ministry spokesman slams a meeting in London between the Israeli intelligence minister and a number of anti-Iran figures that spearheaded riots that erupted in Iran last year. This as Iranians commemorate a massacre by the country's former regime. Nasser Kanani said the meeting showed the continuation of subversive plots by the U.S., U.K. and Israel alliance against Iran. He said the same quote, "Sinister triangle supported the massacre on September 8, 1978 by the Pahlavi regime against an uprising which eventually led to the Islamic Republic. The bloodshed in Tehran has come to be known as Black Friday."
Iranians have marked the Shahrivar 17th uprising by holding a ceremony at Behesht Zahra Cemetery in Tehran. The event was attended by survivors, eyewitnesses, and the families of those killed in the tragic event on September 8, 1978. Later, they paid respect to the martyrs of the uprising by laying wreaths on their graves. On that day, people took to the streets in order to protest against the Pahlavi dictatorship, most of them unaware that just a few hours before, the regime had imposed martial law to prevent anti-regime protests. As a result, hundreds of peaceful protesters were gunned down by Shah's military forces in and around Jalla Square and other parts of southern Tehran.
When Shah's agents started shooting, the crowd fell on the ground like chopped firewood. One was saying Allahu Akbar, the other one was shouting. And from time to time, the soldiers came forward and opened fire on the people. It was a very shocking scene. There was a bloodbath in the street.
Our house was near Jalla Square. When the shooting started, we couldn't go home. The soldiers even came to the surrounding streets. We went inside the half-finished building. The roof was full of Shah's agents and gunmen. We saw that they killed a lot of people down there.
The historical sources say that as many as 4,000 people were shot by guns and military helicopters. Black Friday is believed to have led to the overthrow of Iran's monarchy a few months later. The events triggered protests for another 4 months.
I witnessed that a young man entered the street after buying some bread, but he was shot by the soldiers and fell into a hole dug for phone installation. I and a few other people tried to go to save him, but bullets were fired at us. The poor young man was struggling. One of the local tradesmen finally reached him. Then an ambulance came and took away his dead body.
Black Friday is considered as a symbol of resistance against tyranny and oppression of the time. The event is still remembered as a glory for a nation who gained freedom and independence after years of struggle against monarchy.
According to historians, the Black Friday is seen as a turning point in the fight against the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. It united opposition to the Shah and mobilized the masses, which led to the regime's overthrow in less than 6 months. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says the scourge of slavery continues to pervade the Canadian government's policies in modern shapes and forms. Nasser Kanani said the recent damning statement by the UN Special Rapporteur on contemporary forms of slavery exposes the true nature of Ottawa's discriminatory human rights policies. UN expert Tomoya Obukata released a statement earlier this week after a 14-day visit to Canada. He said Canada's temporary foreign worker programs are breeding ground for contemporary forms of slavery. Obukata said that he was deeply disturbed by the accounts of exploitation and abuse shared with him by migrant workers. He also expressed grave concern by the number of indigenous women and girls who go missing or are murdered, often as a result of being trafficked or forced labor or sexual exploitation. Israeli forces have attacked anti-settlement protesters in the occupied West Bank, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. The troops fired tear gas and rubber bullets at demonstrators in Kafr Qaddoum, east of Ghalrilia. They also attacked protests in several regions near the city of Nablus. Clashes also took place in Qariyut village as Israeli settlers backed by the regime forces staged a provocative raid there. Also earlier on Friday, Israeli forces stormed Shafat refugee camp northeast of Al-Quds, removing Hamas flags and banners supporting the resistance movement. The raid triggered with young Palestinian men, leaving dozens of them injured. Earlier, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us with more details on the latest Israeli attacks against Palestinians.
As usually, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank on Fridays, following the Friday prayers, people take part in anti-Israeli protests and demonstrations. These protests mainly against the illegal settlements and the building of the separation wall that allows the Israelis to confiscate Palestinian lands in order to build a new settlement or annex the settlements, or even build the separation wall around or to separate between Palestinian areas and Israeli fully occupied areas. What happened following Friday prayers? Israeli troops raided a number of Palestinian villages. They raided the village of Kufr Qaddoum. Elsewhere in near Tul Karim, in the village of Kufr Rumman, dozens of Palestinians had been wounded and suffocated due to inhaling this toxic tear gas as the Israeli forces there also raided this village of Kafir Rahman near Tul Karim and attacked the people. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, we also knew that the Israeli forces raided a number of Palestinian villages around Nablus, like Beit Dajan, Beita. So Palestinians every week take part in and organize such protest and demonstrations to tell the Israelis that these lands are theirs and that they will continue to fight the Israeli forces and their policies in every possible way.
Another act of aggression by Israeli regime forces against Al-Aqsa Mosque as they break into one of the prayer halls at the holy site. Troops vandalized properties there and confiscated a number of items. Witnesses say the Friday morning attack caused extensive damage to the prayer hall. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the raid. It called the attack a new crime, which is part of a religious war against Al-Aqsa and its home city, Al-Quds. Hamas said Palestinians will defend their sanctities in the face of plots by Israeli forces and settlers. The Israelis have time and again entered Al-Aqsa or attacked it in the past months. Even the regime's officials have also toured the mosque. Palestinians see all these as provocative and acts of desecration against the mosque. The Israeli regime is facing growing criticism over its soldiers' forced stripping of several Palestinian women during a raid in the occupied West Bank in July. Anger has been boiling ever since news of the insult was broke out by Israeli media this week. We've discussed that in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Time now for our news review segment, where we take a look at one of our stories in more detail. Condemnations are pouring in over Israel's forced stripping of five Palestinian women during a July raid in the occupied West Bank. Dozens of Jordanian lawmakers have denounced the offensive move, calling for the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador to Amman. The lawmakers also urged the government to recall its envoy from Tel Aviv. They called on other parliaments around the world to take practical measures against the regime's crimes against humanity. The Jordanian MPs underlined that the abuses of Palestinian women by Israeli forces show the regime's moral decadence. The United Nations has also called for a thorough examination into the Israeli violation. Plus, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has urged international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end its daily breaches of human rights in Palestine. Anger boils since Monday when Israeli media reported that soldiers had forced five Palestinian women in El Khalil city to undress and walk in front of their children. Joining us for more on that is Jamal Wakim, a professor of international relations at the Lebanese University from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. We also have David Miller, academic broadcaster and investigative researcher from Bristol. Gentlemen, welcome. David, if I could start with you, it's quite graphic, these reports, and you know, rights groups are saying that these incidents have been increasing over the last few months. What's your thoughts?
Well, it's difficult to respond to these kinds of events. It's so beyond the norms of war. It's clearly a collective punishment, and it's an attempt to insult not just the women and the men who are being attacked here, but Islam as a religion itself. And I think that what we see here is a stepping up of the Zionist entities' attacks on the Palestinians. And we have seen this mount over the last year with the new government, with the increasing settler attacks, with the ethnic cleansing in parts of the West Bank and Al-Quds, which mean that it looks like the Zionists are going into what they think is an endgame. And of course, their aim is to remove all or as many Palestinians as they can from all of the territory so they can form a greater Israel. That's been the game plan from the very beginning of Zionism, of course. And so what we see here is a significant escalation, and we have to see what will be the response from the resistance.
Jamal, what's your take on all this? Just when you think the Israeli regime can't sink any lower, it has.
Well, I believe that this is not the first time that the Israelis or Israeli authorities act in a humiliating way towards the civilian Palestinians, including women and children. And this is despite all promises of signing peace, whether with the Palestinian Authority or with the Jordanian government almost three decades ago. Despite this, we still see the occupation of occupied Palestinian territories, in addition of desecrating the Aqsa Mosque and other religious sites, in addition to humiliating and killing civilians. So this is also due to the fact that the United States gives unconditional support for the Zionist entity on one hand, and at the same time it prevents any action by the international community or international organizations, including the United Nations and the International Court of Justice. So that's why the Israelis are acting without fear of being punished, with impunity, actually.
That brings an end to another edition of the News Review.
Moving on, clashes have once again broken out in a Palestinian refugee camp in southern Lebanon. The fighting in the Ain al-Helwa camp involved members of Palestinian authorities, ruling Fatah party, and other militants. We're now joined by our correspondent Mariam Saleh from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, for more details. Mariam, what can you tell us about the recent fighting?
Well, the issue is that what's happening in Ain al-Helwa has become somewhat of a mystery, since the Lebanese government and the army do not enter the camp. And so, though, therefore, they cannot really have their own investigations in order to know how these clashes began. Even the first round of clashes was not clear what was happening. But what we do know is that the two main sides are the Fatah group, which is very strong in Ain al-Helwa camp. Basically, they are the superior faction there. But usually, they are in coordination with all the factions, all the sides. There's usually peace, and there's some sort of a status quo. However, the new factor is the Takfiri factor. They have been dormant cells for the last few years. They were strong at some point, They did have some sort of an uprising, some sort of movement several years ago, but the Lebanese army did stop that in coordination also with the other Palestinian factions. Now we do see that those dormant cells are moving bit by bit. They're even assassinating members of the Fatah Palestinian party. And so this is why these clashes were triggered. We heard from Fatah say that they did not initiate the fighting. However, what they're trying to do is basically stop those Takfiri groups. We're hearing the name, the Daesh also is involved in these clashes for the first time. We have the issue is that there are so many cells that are even against each other. You have Al-Nusra Front, they have a group there. You have the Junud Al-Sham, they have their group there. And now we even have Daesh involved. And so Fatah is trying to basically stop and respond to that fire, where analysts are skeptical. They're fearing that the Fatah cannot take this on alone. They will probably need assistance either from the other factions or probably from the Lebanese army itself, but they do not want another Nahr al-Barid. As you know, in 2007, we had clashes in the Palestinian camp in North Lebanon when the Lebanese army had to basically clean that camp from the Takfiri element over there that was always launching operations and slaughtering, basically, Lebanese army soldiers. So what we are seeing are the continuous clashes. We even have one of the security members of the Lebanese force, security apparatus hurt. You have many people who have been shot and tens, basically, of casualties. You have Daesh reportedly even launched a rocket on one of the ambulances that was trying to evacuate some of these civilians. So therefore, the situation is not calm still, and how this might evolve is not clear. But at the same time, you have the political factions working day and night to try and stop the fighting out.
All right, thanks a lot, Mariam Saleh, joining us from Beirut. Moving on, security is tight in India's capital, New Delhi. Ahead of the G20 summit over the weekend, the Group of 20 is an intergovernmental forum made up of the European Union and 19 rich countries. The two-day summit aims to address issues of global concern like economy, food, and energy security, as well as the war in Ukraine. However, there are divisions at the G20 over those issues, especially the Ukraine war, that has already raised doubts whether participants would be able to put together a final declaration. The West, led by the U.S., wants a clear condemnation of the Ukraine conflict. China and Russia don't accept that, plus leaders from these two countries are not attending the summit. Instead, the Russian foreign minister and the Chinese premier are scheduled to attend. That makes things harder. Developing countries' repayment of their debts is another thorny issue in the event. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. court proceedings in the election interference case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump's trial in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed, a judge said on Thursday, 31st of August. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee said he will allow a YouTube stream of all related hearings and trials stemming from the investigation into the alleged scheme to overturn the state's 2020 presidential election results. The live stream will be operated by the court. There will also be pool coverage for television, radio, and still photography allowed, the judge said. The former President Donald Trump has pleaded not guilty in the case. He surrendered last week at the Fulton County Jail after he and 18 others were indicted for allegedly participating in a criminal enterprise that aimed to overturn his loss in Georgia's 2020 presidential election. Donald Trump is charged with 13 felony counts. A date for his trial has not yet been set. This would be the first time cameras will be allowed to capture full proceedings in one of the four criminal cases brought against Donald Trump this year. Georgia allows cameras in the courtroom as long as they do not disrupt proceedings. A number of photographers were allowed inside the courtroom for a few minutes before the start of the hearing in Trump's arraignment in New York in April, before they had to leave the courtroom. Cameras are typically not allowed in New York courtrooms, but news organizations had asked for an exception. In New York, Donald Trump is charged with allegedly falsifying business records related to hush money payments to conceal damaging information before the 2016 presidential election. Cameras are also not permitted in federal courtrooms. Trump has been charged in two federal cases, one involving his handling of sensitive government documents after he left office, and the other relating to his alleged attempt to stop the transfer of power after the 2020 presidential election. Trump has pleaded not guilty in each of these cases and has claimed the prosecutions are politically motivated. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Court proceedings in the election interference case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants in Fulton County, Georgia, will be televised and live-streamed, a judge ruled on Thursday, 31st of August. Judge Scott McAfee, the judge overseeing the case, said all hearings and trials will be broadcast on the Fulton County Court YouTube channel, according to multiple outlets. He also said pool coverage for broadcast news media will be allowed. Donald Trump and his co-defendants are charged in a sprawling racketeering case relating to efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in Georgia. The case could be the only one against Donald Trump the public is able to witness. He also faces two federal indictments, one relating to the mishandling of classified information, and another also relates to the 2020 election interference. But federal courtrooms generally do not allow cameras. The former president also faces charges in Manhattan relating to the hush money payments before the 2016 presidential election. However, if any of the defendants get their case transferred to federal courtrooms, as former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows is attempting to do, Judge McAfee's ruling would not apply in that case. Mark Meadows took the stand in Atlanta, Georgia, on Monday at a hearing where he argued his case should be moved. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones did not rule on the case at the hearing and will issue a ruling in writing at a later time, according to multiple reports. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. The Fulton County, Georgia judge overseeing the sprawling 2020 election interference racketeering case against former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants says that all proceedings in his courtroom relating to the case will be live-streamed and allowed to be televised. The ruling, however, would be subject to change and would not apply to any portions of the case moved to federal courtrooms. In a court hearing on Thursday, 31st of August, Superior Court of Fulton County Judge Scott McAfee, who was assigned the case, said he would make all hearings and possible trials available to be broadcast on the Fulton County Court YouTube channel. Judge McAfee also said that he will allow broadcast news media to have pool cameras where groups of news organizations combine their resources and share camera access in the courtroom. Neither defense attorneys nor prosecutors appeared in court on Thursday, 31st of August, to oppose the news media's request for cameras. Thursday, Judge McAfee also ruled to allow members of the media to use cell phones and computer electronics in the courtroom for non-recording purposes such as note-taking. Judge McAfee's ruling is limited to the Fulton County state case. Multiple defendants in Georgia's sprawling state racketeering case, including former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark, are asking for their cases to be moved to federal courtrooms, where there are no cameras allowed. Computers or smartphones are also not allowed in the court. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones could rule at any time on Mark Meadows' bid to move the Fulton County election subversion case to a federal courtroom, now that Meadows and the district attorney have filed dueling briefs weighing in on a follow-up legal question posed by the judge after Monday's hearing on the matter. U.S. District Judge Steve Jones had specifically asked the parties whether the case should be moved if the court found that at least one of the episodes described in the racketeering case pertained to conduct that Mark Meadows carried out under the color of his federal office. District Attorney Fannie Willis argued in her new brief that such a finding would not be sufficient for the case to be moved. Mark Meadows' attorney said it would be sufficient.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Dr. Shomali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, لَيْسَ شَيْءٌ أَنْكَى لِإِبْلِيسِ وَجُنُودِهِ. There is nothing that would defeat and, you know, frustrate Shaitan and his army more than this one. من زيارة الإخوان في الله بعضهم لبعض. مؤمنين visiting each other. Shaitan wants separation. Shaitan wants a hatred, dislike, not trusting each other, not loving each other. So, ziyara is a great gate of tawfiq, a great bab or gate for getting benefit from what? Not just from what you have achieved, from visiting someone else. When we visit someone else for the sake of Allah, this creates a sanctity, a holy space that you benefit, the other person also benefits, and also the entire community benefits. But now, imagine if we visit holy people, awliya Allah. If we visit, for example, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. If we visit Amirul Mu'mineen, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Lady Ma'suma, Lady Zainab, of course, then this is even greater. Why? Because what we said so far was for someone that might be at your level or even lower than you. Maybe you are not a holy person. That person is not a holy person, but there is a holy space. Because Allah says, you are visiting me. It's a holy space created. When two mu'min, their lights are connected, a holy space is created. But if there is a person who is already a holy person, whose house is a sacred place, whose house is an example of في بيوت أذن الله أن ترفع ويذكر فيها اسمه. آيات النور. Allah says, where you can find the niche inside which there is lantern. Yeah, مشكات فيها مصباح المصباح في زجاجة. We don't have time to talk about this. So where can you find that light, that lantern? في بيوت أذن الله أن ترفع ويذكر فيها اسمه يسبح له فيها بالغدوب والآصال. These can be found in some houses in which there are people who are continuously remembering Allah. Okay? So, what we said was a mu'min, for the sake of Allah, visits another mu'min. So, when they are meeting each other, they are remembering Allah, a holy space is created. But if someone is dying with dhikr, لَجَالٌ لَا تُلْهِهِمْ تَجَارَةٌ وَلَا بَيْعُونَ ذِكْرِ اللَّهِ, their house is a house from which light comes. Suyuti in Durrul Mansur says, when Rasulullah was reciting this ayah fi buyutin, a person stood up and said, which buyut are these? Ayyu buyutin hazihi, ya Rasulullah. Rasulullah said, buyutul anbiya. These are the houses of the prophets. Then, faqama ilayha Abu Bakr, the first caliph stood up and pointed at the house of Imam Ali and Lady Fatima and said, is this one of them? Although Rasulullah said, Buyutul Anbiya. But he asked this question, which is a good question. Rasulullah said, Na'am wa min afadhilha. Yes, indeed, it's one of the best of them. Why? Maybe someone says, Rasulullah said, Buyutul Anbiya. Imam Ali is not prophet. Lady Fatima is not prophet. First of all, we say, Ithbatu shay. Layan fima ada. When you affirm something, it doesn't negate others. Rasulullah said, Buyutul Anbiya are included. He didn't say there is no other bait. But the better answer is that Lady Fatima and Amirul Mu'mineen, they don't have house of their own. They are Ahlu Baytan Nabi. The house belongs to the Prophet. But because they have the same quality of لا تلهيهم تجارة ولا بيع عن ذكر الله, they can be household of the same house. So, inshallah, those who go to Karbala, to Najaf, to Qadhimain, to Samarra these days, they should know that they are visiting the house of Rasulullah. When we go for as a dukhul to Mashhad, for example. What do you say? Allahumma inni waqaftu ala babin min abwab buyut nabiyyik. This is Mashhad. I know it's not Medina, but still I say, I am standing at one of the gates of the house of the Prophet. So, no matter from which entrance you enter, spiritually they are all connected. Rasulullah is there, Amirul Mu'minin is there, Lady Fatima is there, Lady Khadija is there. People know it as Shrine of Imam Hussein or Imam Ali, but it's all houses of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And this is why then you say salam to the Prophet. If Prophet was not there, why you say salam to the Prophet? And also house of the Prophet is connected to the house of the other Prophets. These houses are all connected to the house of others. Therefore you can say salam to Adam, to Isa, to Musa, to Ibrahim. Because there is no separation. It's just where you have access, where you are more familiar, where you are connected. Otherwise, even if someone goes to Hazrat Abdul Azim, for example, Imam alayhi salam said, visiting Hazrat Abdul Azim is like visiting Imam Hussein. Because they are all connected with each other. And Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam have always asked Shia not to neglect local shrines. Okay, it's not that all the Shia only go to one shrine. But among all the gates of the house of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, there is something special with respect to Karbala. Although Imam Hussein is Husaynun minni wa ana min Hussein, and this is a house of the grandson of the Prophet, this is house of the Prophet, but there is a special barakah in this house. And this has lots of aspects. You can discuss this spiritually. You can also discuss this with respect to eschatology, about what is going to happen in Akhir al-Zaman and the connection between Imam Hussein and Imam Mahdi. Ajjalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. There are lots of things why so much emphasis is put on ziyar of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
The credit rating agency Fitch has downgraded the U.S. government's top credit rating on Tuesday, 1st of August, a move that drew an angry response from the White House. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered the story and tells us more. Fitch Ratings has downgraded U.S. credit from the highest rating, citing the nation's growing debt and its eroding political stability. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, the ratings agency said on Tuesday, 1st of August. The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management in the United States. The rating agency also cited the U.S.'s complex budgeting process and its lack of a medium-term financial planning relative to its peers in explaining the downgrade to AA+ from the U.S.'s previous AAA level. These factors, combined with the fiscal shocks from the pandemic, new spending and tax cuts, have brought the debt to 113% of the national economic output, well above pre-pandemic levels. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen described the new credit rating, calling it arbitrary and baseless on outdated data. Fitch's decision does not change what Americans, investors and people all around the world already know, that Treasury's securities remain the world's preeminent safe and liquid asset, and that the American economy is fundamentally strong, Janet Yellen said in a statement that touted the U.S.'s economic recovery from the coronavirus recession and the administration's plans to reduce the budget deficit. Reduced credit ratings could lead the U.S. to pay higher interest rates on Treasury notes, on bills and bonds, according to the Associated Press. We strongly disagree with this decision, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said in a statement. The ratings model used by Fitch declined under President Trump and then improved under President Biden, and it defies reality to downgrade the United States at a moment when President Biden has delivered the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world. The United States last faced a downgrade in 2011 when Standard & Poor's cut the nation's credit rating one notch after prolonged wrangling in Congress brought the U.S. close to a debt default. The website npr.org, National Public Radio, has also covered the same story. Fitch Ratings cut the United States' credit rating by one notch from the top-rated AAA to AA+, saying rising deficits and political brinkmanship are imperiling the U.S. government's ability to pay its debts. The downgrade comes just 2 months after the Biden administration and House Republicans agreed to suspend the government's debt ceiling in a last-minute deal, narrowly avoiding a potentially disastrous federal default. It marks another rebuke for the United States, which lost its AAA rating from Standard & Poor's back in 2011, in the midst of another debt ceiling standoff. Today, only one of the three major credit rating agencies, Moody's Investors Service, gives the United States a top-notch AAA rating. Fitch acknowledged the strength of the U.S. economy and the advantages convened by the dollar's role as the world's most important currency. But the credit rating agency warned of mounting red ink and an unwillingness in both political parties to grapple with long-term fiscal challenges, while expressing little confidence in the U.S. government's ability to manage the country's finances. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance in the United States over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, the credit rating agency said in announcing the downgrade. The repeated debt limit, political standoffs, and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management in the United States. The move drew swift pushback from the Biden administration. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen called it arbitrary and based on outdated information. Fitch's decision does not change what Americans, investors, and people all around the world already know, Janet Yellen said in a statement. Treasury securities remain the world's preeminent safe and liquid asset, and the American economy is fundamentally strong. Fitch notes that spending limits adopted as part of the debt deal, clinched in June, cover only a small fraction of the overall budget and don't address long-term challenges in financing Social Security and Medicare for an aging population. Tax cuts and government spending have led to widening government deficits in recent years, and with rising interest rates, the cost of bridging that gap has increased. Government interest payments in the first 9 months of the fiscal year totaled $652 billion, a 25% increase from the same period a year earlier. Today's downgrade should be a wake-up call, said Maya McGuinness, president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Maya McGuinness added, "We are clearly on an unsustainable fiscal path, and we need to do better." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. Rating agency Fitch downgraded the US government's top credit rating on Tuesday, 1st of August, a move that drew an angry response from the Biden White House and surprised investors. Fitch downgraded the United States to AA+ from its AAA rating, citing fiscal deterioration over the next 3 years and repeated down-the-wire debt ceiling negotiations that threaten the U.S. government's ability to pay its bills. It is the second major rating agency after Standard & Poor's to strip the United States of its AAA rating. Fitch had first flagged the possibility of a downgrade back in May amid the U.S. debt ceiling negotiations, then maintained that position in June after the crisis was resolved, saying it intended to resolve the review in the third quarter of this year. After the announcement, the U.S. dollar fell across a range of currencies, stock futures ticked down and Treasury futures rose. But several investors and analysts said they expected the impact of the downgrade to be limited. The move came despite the resolution of the U.S. debt ceiling crisis 2 months ago. Joe Biden and the Republican-controlled House of Representatives reached a debt ceiling agreement in May Following months of political brinkmanship and wrangling, the deal lifted the government's $31.4 trillion borrowing limit. In Fitch's view, there has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance in the United States over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, notwithstanding the June bipartisan agreement to suspend the debt limit until January of 2025. The rating agency said in a statement, "The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management by the U.S. government," it said. Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, said she disagreed with Fitch's downgrade in a statement that calls it arbitrary and based on outdated data. The Biden White House had a similar view, saying it strongly disagrees with this decision. "It defies reality to downgrade the United States at the moment when President Biden has delivered the strongest recovery of any major economy in the world," said Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House's press secretary. Investors use credit ratings to assess the risk profile of companies and governments when they raise financing in the debt capital market. Generally, the lower a borrower's credit rating, the higher its financing costs.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023, in the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. If you look at the biographies of martyrs who defended the shrines of the Prophet's household in Syria and Iraq, the martyrs who defended the shrines and the martyrs who have given their lives for the nation's security during these years. If you read their biographies, you will find that the attraction of the IRGC's presence and its history have been the most important, effective factors in the growth and movement and in the formation of these personalities. Young people take others as role models and are influenced by them. When an organization is mission-oriented, is working to reach an ideal situation, is ready to take action, and adheres to its values in practice, this organization becomes appealing to others. Not only is the organization appealing, its members are also appealing. Its members are appealing to any spiritual heart. Its high-ranking commander, such as Martyr Soleimani, is self-sacrificing young men such as Martyr Hojaji, and its humble and brave guards such as Martyr Ibrahim Hadi are all appealing. Each one of them is a role model, an everlasting role model. So this is another part of the IRGC's performance.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Now, if we were to speak about the outside of the country's borders, it would be a very long discussion. Discussing the effects of the IRGC's movement, presence, goals, orientations, and actions on the youth of the other countries is something that requires a very long discussion. And I don't want to begin that discussion at the moment. But it is very important. So, that was the brief word regarding the IRGC. Now, if you pay attention, you will find that an important part of the enemy's activities is distorting the image of the IRGC and distorting the image of Basij. Why? Because the IRGC and the Basij are appealing. Their appealing nature worries and frightens the enemy. So the enemy feels they need to distort their image with fake news, false rumors, and using all kinds of tricks and deceptions.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.